Morning again, Mr. Roots. You have 15 minutes. You want to reserve any rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
3 minutes?
Yes, sir.
All right, so you may proceed.
Thank you. As I began my argument with the trial court, I'd start my argument here by saying I understand what Mr. Howard is suggesting is probably an idea born from a different era here in the Commonwealth, that that the announcement of a grand jury indictment would be read in open court. Sounds crazy in the world we live in with, you know, maybe I think Newport News probably puts out 100 to 150 indictments per grand jury. You know, there may be other places that are smaller, but you can understand maybe in the 19th century with two or three, as it is in Surrey these days.
None of the cases that I'm aware of require that the indictment be read aloud. Where does that come from?
Well, it wasn't really an idea until I read it in the 09 Reed case, Judge, where the presiding judge in that case indicated that, well, when the grand jury came back, the attorney was sitting there, and the defendant could have shown up, and they could have made objections at that point. Whereas I think it was the way that things were done in the 19th century here, I think that's what they were hearkening back to, that he could have made his objections to the indictment that he knew about
Reed
at that point.
Reed doesn't say indictments must be even announced. It simply cites the reasoning in White, which was a 1878 case. But Reed, as I read it, you can disagree, doesn't address what are the requirements of presenting the indictment.
It didn't address it at all, Judge. I don't disagree with the court at all. I said that Reed is suggesting that there was the opportunity, just to what the judge said to counsel during the hearing and what they wrote in the opinion, or what was written in the opinion, that the presiding judge there said, well, you could have objected when it was brought back from the grand jury. That's his opportunity, so to speak, according to that presiding judge. That's where the idea comes from, Judge, and that Reed goes on to say that it has to be presented in open court, Judge, the Commonwealth.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't been on the circuit bench in a number of years. Grand jury comes back. Court says something like, has grand jury completed its business, and you have indictments. Mm-hmm. And then the trial court says to the clerk, or some way the sheriff gets the indictments, hands them to the clerk. Clerk reviews them and hands them to the court. Isn't that presented in open court?
I guess that's the argument. Is that enough? But I look for that particular verbiage throughout the history of the Commonwealth and didn't find it, quite honestly.
Yeah.
The Commonwealth did something I wanted to put in, you know, a Black Law Dictionary of announce or a Webster's definition of announce, and I came across the same definition the Commonwealth used, that it has to be made public or put into the public for review, something to that effect. Judge, that sounds to me like it needs to be read so that somebody can be aware of what it is.
Does arraignment serve but that? In fact, often, probably most often, the defendant's not going to be there when the grand jury returns. And isn't that why the arraignment absolutely requires a verbatim reading?
Well, that's initially and instinctively, that's what I would say would have fixed the problem. You know, it's like going from the juvenile court to the circuit court. If you don't follow all the procedures of the circuit court to get a child to be an adult, getting an indictment fixes it. So that's where I thought it, where I initially started looking and thought that's what I would find. But then you come across Gilligan that says arraignment just isn't the answer. And that, Judge, I understand it's an old case, but it goes back to my original thing. This is from a different era of jurisprudence, I think. Gilligan says arraignment doesn't fix the problem. It's not advising the defendant what he's charged with then. It's the announcement. It says it doesn't fix what the court is asking. Gilligan, I think, and it's Gant. I really can't tell the court the site, but it's like 1896. That's how old the idea is, you know, Your Honor. That's what I'm conceding, that in today's modern world, this idea probably doesn't fit very well, but Reed kind of suggests that it's alive and has to be done.
Let's assume the law requires that it be announced.
Yes, sir.
Or read. What is the prejudice to your client? Reed said it was okay for a lack of signature by the foreman.
What's the prejudice, Your Honor? The just as I was saying before, that the trial court, in speaking at the hearing, that says that that's your chance to object to the form of the indictment. Well, we know there's another procedure down the road, but I guess that's your first chance. And if you were aware that you had
to... suggested, I don't remember many docket calls where the defendant showed up.
That's why I called Ms. Lizjack, the docket control clerk, to put that on the record, because Mr. Anderson says directly he hadn't been to a grand jury, but I knew Ms. Lizjack, even though I wasn't there, I knew she was there because she's there at every grand jury. Right. So she would be the one to put those facts on the record. And that's why I asked her, is there a court reporter there to record these things, just to take it out of the question, you know, what happened. If we had a record of it, we wouldn't have to worry about it.
Let me maybe back up one step. I assume from your argument that the question we have to resolve is, what is an indictment?
Valid indictment, Your Honor. Yes, sir, because that's what gives the court jurisdiction, and that's why.
I mean, ultimately, don't we have to go back to the statutes?
Yes,
we
do. Yes, sir.
And the only statute I can find that really remotely applies here is that requires an indictment for the prosecution of a felony.
220, Your Honor?
I think it's before that. 220 is the contents of the indictment.
Oh, okay.
But in any event, I mean, we're engaging in statutory construction.
Interpretation more than construction, I'd imagine, Judge. Yes, sir.
Well, as you mentioned, that the technology and procedures have changed considerably since these old cases came out. Why wouldn't we interpret the statute in light of modern-day technology and all of the other statutory changes that allow the clerks to record things electronically rather than on the old order books?
Well, Judge, not as a concession, but I think that's where the argument is here. It's more in 17.1240 than it is in the actual announcement of an indictment in open court. The announcement is ceremonial. Maybe there's a little procedural there, a little protection for the potential defendant. But the problem is, in my opinion, in this case, is the document that was presented to represent the recording of the indictment in the Newport News order book. And I should like to say that I'm not trying to necessarily impugn the whole system of Newport News, just what was done to Mr. Howard and what was presented in his case, because, you know, he recognized and I recognize that if what could happen, if the court agrees with him, that he wasn't indicted. And but in this particular case, the documents, which is commonly...
Double jeopardy wouldn't attach, would it?
Probably not, but it would cause a lot of extra work for a lot of folks. And the potential, really, kind of quickly off the subject, those purported convictions that come forward for perhaps possession by a convicted felon then become challenged on a valid indictment or a valid conviction. That's where the real problem is.
Is this a jurisdictional issue?
I think it is, Your Honor. I think it's 17.1514 is a valid indictment gives the court the jurisdiction to try the case.
So your argument would literally, for all intents and purposes,
in my career, yes, sir,
the president of the penitentiary. I mean, everybody incarcerated that didn't have their indictment read in court would be able to challenge the jurisdiction of the trial court.
I think not if you're already convicted, Your Honor, because none of those individuals had the evidentiary hearing we had in Mr. Howard's case. Who knows what the procedure is in Surrey County or Buchanan or any of the western counties or Fairfax County, you know, those types of things. They may be valid. I don't know.
I can pretty much guarantee you they don't read every indictment in Fairfax County.
Yes, sir. I've been there too. And Judge, I'm coming down to my time. I really want to get to the 240 argument, but again, that's not where the argument is here. I think it's really what was presented in court to say that this has been properly recorded, and when you don't have that answered, everybody that's already been convicted can't then go back and reinvent the wheel, I don't think. I think it's what goes forward from whenever whatever happens with Mr. Howard's case. I'm only in Mr. Howard's case. Has he been validly convicted? And the real, to me, again, the real problem is what was presented. The dot matrix printing of names with the charges next to them. I read 17.1240 to say that there has to be a process that creates an image of the document.
Let me interrupt you and see if I can summarize. There was an order that listed the indictment number, the name, and the offense, right?
Correct.
But your argument is that the actual indictment has to be spread in the order book.
Yes, sir.
Is that your bottom line?
Yes, sir. That's what he's relying on. And clearly, just a list of names isn't the indictment, Mr. Anderson. The Commonwealth attorney in the actual hearing didn't choose to present the indictments that may or may not be reduced to a smaller form or reduced, you know, like on a microfiche or microfilm. They chose to present this dot matrix printout. And there may be pictures, images, as 240 requires, of the indictments somewhere on the computers or on a microfilm or microfiche of in the clerk's office in Newport News, but they chose not to present it. So when the record presented, I didn't think that they, well, I don't believe that they have complied with 17.1-240.
How would you be prejudiced by that?
Well, Reed clearly states that it's a twofold process, that it has to be presented in open court and recorded in order to be a valid indictment. And if it's not properly recorded, Your Honor, I don't think that he had been properly indicted. And that's really the crux of the argument. Do you have to take a picture of the indictment, put it on a computer, put it on a piece of plastic or photographic film and preserve it somewhere? And it's kind of, I think it's probably best, well, I've seen it best done is in the city of Norfolk. You walk into the clerk's office, you can sit down at a terminal, and you can see everything that's in a file, or you can see the contents of whatever the clerk has there. Under this procedure, all you're going to see is a list of names and what they're charged with, not a photograph of the indictment. I think that's what 17.1240 requires. Thank you.
Thank you. Morning, Ms. Martin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. As the Court has noted, none of the cases that talk about whether or not an indictment is valid or not say that the indictment must be read aloud in open court. The language that they use is presented, returned, announced, excuse me, and none of those things mean the same thing as it must be read in open court. And the Reed case, the issue there was that the grand jury forgot to sign the indictments as true bills. And so when the defendant made his motion to vacate, the trial court that heard that motion made a finding in its order that the indictments had been returned in open court. That was not challenged in the Virginia Supreme Court when Reed appealed. And so there was no finding in that opinion or even anything said.
What case says it has to be announced?
I think that language is used, I believe it's used in the White case, which is the 1878 case. I think that they used the word announced there. In that case, was there the endorsement had said a true gun instead of a true bill on the indictment.
But don't all the rest of the cases talk about presented?
Yes, I believe they do. I believe that presented in open court is the word that is used most often. The Simmons case, that the language there was that it had not been delivered in court. But none of them say that it has to be read aloud. And there's no further requirement that the defendant be present when these indictments are returned, because the defendant, unless he had ESP or something, might not know that he was going to be charged with anything, and so he's not going to be sitting there waiting to see if they call out his name. And so if you look at those cases, you know, clearly you look at the procedure that was done here. The deputy clerk said that she was present at docket call, that the grand jury came back, reviewed the indictments to make sure that their proper form, that they'd been signed by the foreman. The court entered an order on July 12th saying that the indictments had been returned, and it listed them all, and there were a bunch of them, and the defendant's two charges were listed in that order. So certainly there is an order that talks about how these indictments have been returned, and it was open court, as the deputy clerk testified to. Certainly there's just no merit to the defendant's argument that they have to be read aloud to be proper. And furthermore, this is not any kind of jurisdictional defect. An indictment can be waived. It's a statutory requirement. And so certainly there are cases, some habeas cases that was cited in the brief, that unless it's a situation where there's such a problem with the indictment that the defendant has no way of knowing what he was charged with or no way to present a defense, that it's not the kind of error that creates a jurisdictional problem.
Who does the presenting? Is it the grand jury or the judge in terms of the indictments must be presented in open court?
Well, the order in this case talked about how the grand jury returned into court having found the following indictments. So, I mean, I think that if you look at the language and the way the cases talk about this, that the grand jury presents them to the court and then the court has them. I don't think that... So I think it's really the grand jury that's doing the presenting after they have made their findings.
I haven't done any research, but common sense would indicate the purpose that it had to be presented in open court is so there won't be any secret indictments or the grand jury meets behind closed doors and does whatever they want without the public seeing the process.
Right, and so... And then once the indictments are returned and they're available, then they're available in court. I mean, they would they're there. It's not like the there are probably cases where they're sealed for some reason or something, but that's not the situation that we would have here. And so the defendant, there was some testimony, I believe, from the chief deputy clerk that the indictments themselves were put into each individual case file so that they existed with the file itself for the person, the defendant. But the order is sort of an efficient shorthand way of keeping them all together because certainly there were many of these and just the amount of paper and space and so forth that it would take up to have those all in this particular kind of order situation. So once the defendant gets the indictment and it's served on him, then if he has a problem with it, then there are processes by which he can challenge it. And
do we really know what transpired when that grand jury returned? I mean, how these indictments were delivered, what was said. I mean, we have testimony from a deputy clerk that they didn't read the indictments aloud.
Right.
But we don't know, for instance, whether somebody read the name of the defendant and the charges.
No, we don't know. That information is not in the record. And there's just no way to know.
I know that the deputy clerk checked to be sure
right.
the signatures were on.
Right, but she reviewed them for form. She reviewed them to make sure that they were signed. So, you know, I think she said that she looked at them, you know, then she maybe gave them to the judge, to the court. But there's no other testimony as to exactly what happened minute by minute. And I think that, but again, because none of these cases talk about that kind of procedure. There is no case that I found that said you must do A, B, and C for this to be proper. You know, it's just sort of a general term that they're presented, they're returned, and just in the common sense way of doing things, the courts knew what that meant because that's the way they did it.
But if, I mean, we're arguing about this language presented in open court. The appellant reads that to mean read the entire indictment, but it could just as well mean read the name of the defendant and the charge for which he's been indicted.
It
John
could.
Smith, I'm announcing that John Smith has been indicted for murder.
It could.
And we don't know whether that was done here or not.
But we don't know whether it was done here, but we also don't know that
isn't
is...
Isn't that what the order that was introduced says? Was done?
Well, the order, I believe, says that the grand jury returned into court having found the following indictments, and then it lists all the
lists
people.
The name.
And the charges.
The charge.
And all of that.
That it was a true bill, that it was a felony.
Right. Right.
Well, isn't that a court order saying that they returned?
Yes, I mean, that is.
And we also have the order, the indictment itself is part
yes.
of this record, showing
yes.
that it was signed,
yes.
was a true bill.
Yes. So we have all of those things.
And ended up in the court case file.
Yes. So, I mean, we have all of those things. But, so there's just... There's just nothing that says, you know, that you have to say the person's name or any of that kind of thing. And also here, I mean, the defendant's not saying that he didn't know what he was charged with. He's not saying that his defense was somehow hindered. He's just kind of making this technical argument, well, nobody read it out in court, so therefore I shouldn't be charged and I'm not guilty. And that's just not common sense. So certainly the trial court was not wrong in holding that the indictment had been properly presented and that it had jurisdiction over the case. Now, with regard to whether or not it had been properly recorded, 17.2.123 says that orders must be recorded in the order book, but a physical order book is not required. In 2007, that particular statute was amended so that it can be in electronic format, and that's the way it was done here, that the chief deputy clerk testified that the information was stored in the computer, that with the click of the button he could print out this order that showed exactly what happened, that listed all of these people, all of their indictments. There's a recent attorney general opinion that says that if you have an electronic case management system that contains all of the information that would normally go in an order book, that qualifies as an order book under the statute. And so certainly just because a record is in electronic form doesn't mean that it's not valid. There was an order that was here, kept electronically, and it was printed out for the purposes of the hearing on the defendant's motion, so it does exist. And so certainly, it was properly recorded. The trial court was not wrong in its decision on that as well. And for all of these reasons, we would ask that the convictions be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Morton. Mr. Roots. 3 minutes.
The proper recording of the order book, or the existence of the order book, is, as I understand it, and it's the historical significance of it is, it's just as Judge Petty, I believe, was indicated, so that there's no secrets or that everything is kind of transparent, so that if you have the order book and you walk in and say as a newspaper reporter and you want to know what happened on July 9th, 2012, or 2012, in the Newport News grand jury, you can go in and you can see James Howard was indicted, and this is the charge.
The problem I'm having, it almost seems to me that as far as what happened when the grand jury met, that we need either a transcript or a written statement of facts, and we don't have that.
I can't give you page and verse where it occurred, but part of the argument was I asked the court for that particular transcript. And that's why I asked Ms. Lisjack, is that procedure recorded? And I asked Mr. Anderson, who's the deputy clerk, is it recorded?
But we could.
There was no, I can't give you what doesn't exist is problem.
Well, we could have had a written statement of fact, though. And we don't know whether these were announced or not. And if we don't know, we can't reverse a trial court.
Right. But Judge Petty, I've tried my best not to totally give that argument away, but I really don't think the best argument is the announcement in open court. Our best argument, the better of the two is the actual recording. And
equally good arguments, the stronger one is.
Yes, sir. That's what I meant to say, Your Honor. And I think it's in the recording of the indictment in the order book, and clearly 123. 17.1.123. It's a notification. It's a transparency thing. You can go and see what happened any day of the court, and that by not complying with 17.1.240, it invalidates or makes it impossible to do what 17.1.123 and 124 want, which is here's what happened that day. This is the indictment. Here's a picture of it, because 17.1240 clearly requires, in order to have the document spread upon the books, it has to create an image through one of the three processes, micrographic, I can't call them off the top of my head, they're my brief, but there are three ways to do it, and what hasn't been presented, and it's not in the record, is there's an arbiter of how to do it. There's the Virginia Law Library sets the rules as to how to do it, and it when you set those rules, it brings to mind that if the court, say the Charter of the Commonwealth, I'm ignorant of history, quite honestly, everybody's required to sign it, and all this, you know, each circuit court records the signing of the Charter of the Commonwealth. If you don't have a picture of the charter with the signature on it, what good is it? If it's just listed in dot matrix, we signed it. It's the same thing as we have here. And so,
if we've got the two indictments on page 4 and 5,
yes, sir,
and they are part of this record,
yes, sir,
how can you say the court does not have a record of the image of the indictment?
Not in the order book. Mr. Anderson, the chief deputy.
Where is the requirement that the indictment be recorded in the order book?
17.1, 123, and 124 say that the occurrences of the circuit court for
proceedings,
that.
Proceedings? Doesn't say the indictment has to be, does it? It says, I guess, the court's proceedings must be.
Well, Judge, that I think if having it written down, somebody else's opinion, what happened versus the actual thing, what happened, where you can look at it and see it for yourself and blow it up or reduce it, and is
but all you have to do is punch that record number that appears in the grand jury order, and you get a picture of that image of that indictment, don't you?
Now, that's what I asked Mr. Anderson. He says he only puts the indictment in each person's file. That's part of his testimony. He doesn't record.
What is that number?
What is that number?
It's the file number.
Correct, but I think what 17.1240 is saying is that there needs to be, and this is becoming awfully technical and modern, there needs to be a file that says 2012 or July 2012 grand jury with all the indictments in it.
Thank you, Mr. Roots.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will greet counsel and take up Wallace versus Commonwealth.